It's money that we need, cause if we're only mouths to feed, I know no matter what you say, there's some debts you'll never pay. Working for the church while your family dies, you take what they give you and you keep it inside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Misha Glinney, the author of a new book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. He is formerly the BBC Central Europe correspondent, having covered the fall of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia, and is the author of McMafia, The Rebirth of History, The Fall of the Yugoslavia, and the Balkans, Nationalism, War, and the Great Powers, 1804 to 1990. What is that, 1990?
It's 1999.
1999. And he has also been a regular consultant to the U.S. and European governments on major policy issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Misha Glinney.
Thanks very much, Ian. It's really nice to be here.
And this is, we always hear how the internet and the computer are going to solve everything. Everybody has these utopian ideas that have been here since the beginning of the internet age. But you've really gone into the dystopian side of it. And I must say, just as a regular user of the internet, albeit rather limited in a limited way since I'm something of an electronic Luddite, I can't stand the amount of thievery, blatant nonsense, these letters from Nigerians offering me millions of dollars and now I'm winning BMWs all around the world. Why is this such a wild west?
Well, it's a wild west because I'm afraid it's very lucrative. You know, I mean, once you have the ability to send a message like that, one of the Nigerian scams, they're known as 419 scams, out to tens of millions, if not more, recipients on the web, and that you know that even if you get a sort of zero, a 0.001 pickup on that, then you're going to make significant numbers of money, amounts of money, then people are going to do it, I'm afraid. And it's the scale out that the internet facilitates that makes this such an attractive prospect for people who want to commit scams, essentially. That's what the thing is. I mean, it's quite astonishing. I had a conversation with somebody who works for Bell Canada, which is one of the major telecoms providers in Canada. And he said he covers the whole of the – he was the head of security at Bell Canada. He covers the whole of the Western Canadian area. He says that in a month, they facilitate the sending and receipt of 25 billion emails. And of those, 24 billion are scam emails. They're phishing emails. They're spam. This is absolutely extraordinary because actually one of the problems we have on the internet is that it's too overcrowded. We don't have enough so-called bandwidth. And it's not surprising when you think that 24 out of 25 emails is just spam, is illegal stuff that's going through, and the internet is facilitating that. So is Bell Canada and so is everybody else.
And what is the spam capital of the world, or is it all, you know, in the electronic ether?
Well, it's in the electronic ether, but you can actually check and see where spam is being sent from. You can go onto various sites. There's a good one called Team Cymru, which is slightly peculiar because it means it's the word for Wales in Welsh. It's actually an American firm, but one of the founders is Welsh, and it's Team and then dash C Y M ru.org, and they have a real-time globe telling you which country is generating most spam at that particular time. And what you'll see, a lot of it goes through American servers. I mean, America is the number one because that's where a lot of the spam is targeted, and so it'll come through American servers, and some Russians or Brazilians or Brits or whoever will hire servers in the US to send out spam. But mainly you'll see that the pattern is for emerging markets as the center of spam and actually of cybercrime on the web as well. This is Brazil, Russia, India and China. More recently, Indonesia, Turkey have become big centers for cybercriminal activity.
Again, I'm speaking with Misha Glennie, the author of a new book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. And obviously one would not expect Russia and China's government to necessarily crack down on small cyber crooks, since at the highest level they practice cyber warfare. The Russians went after Georgia and Latvia, and the Chinese apparently have been very successful. I talked to specialists over here in national security affairs who said that the Chinese looked like they actually got inside a lot of mainframes and stayed for months and took down incredible stuff. There's a report that the Chinese have all of the latest nuclear weapons designs of the United States, the most up-to-date warhead designs, etc.
That's right. I mean, the Chinese are on steroids when it comes to internet espionage. There are a couple of interesting points here, Ian, which are important to sort of tease out. First of all, in the case of Russia and Ukraine, for example, but particularly Russia, what you have is Russian criminals. Russia has an Orwellian system of control over its internet called SORM2, which means that every ISP, internet service provider, has to send a mirror image of every single bit of data that goes across the internet in Russia to KGB servers in Moscow. So the KGB knows everything, or the FSB as it's now called, knows everything going on the internet in Russia. So how come then Russia is such a big center, and it is a huge center of cyber criminal activity, of hosting child pornography sites and this sort of thing? The reason is that the Russian government said when the first sort of superstore for criminals on the web was founded, Carta Planet, in 2001. Dark Market, the title of my book, was a later one of those sites. These are sort of criminal websites where people can buy and sell stolen credit card details, viruses, whatever they want. It's a sort of, you know, it's a fun forum for criminals on the web. And Carta Planet was the first of these. And there was an explicit agreement between the people who worked in Carta Planet out of Odessa in Ukraine and the Russian government, whereby they were allowed to scam people and steal credit cards in Western Europe and North America to their heart's content, provided they didn't attack the financial institutions or any other institutions of the Russian Federation. And had they done so, they would have been picked up straight away and thrown in Siberia for the rest of their lives. Now, the other quid pro quo that the Russian government demanded of these criminals and criminal hackers was that in the event that Russia needed them for reasons of national security, i.e. the attacks against Estonia in the Baltics in 2008 and Georgia in 2007 and Georgia in 2008, then the criminal hackers had to jump too, and they did. And they provided the kind of muscle, the sort of digital muscle for the attacks on Estonia and Georgia. But let's just for a moment invert the whole thing and look at the way the world works if you are a senior general with cyber at the KGB, the FSB, or if you're a senior officer in the PLA, the People's Liberation Army of China, with responsibility for cyber. What you see is a United States that has considerable control over the actual functioning of the internet, of how it works. You see a combination of the National Security Agency, the NSA, and Britain's digital spy agency, along with Australia's, New Zealand's, and Canada's, which is the most powerful spy agency in history. And you see the United States has domain name control and jurisdiction over the two largest depositories of personal data in the world, which are very, very valuable, Google and Facebook. So if you're an FBI officer or an NSA officer and you want to get into somebody's Gmail account, you can do that within 24 hours if you've got a court order. If you're a British or a Canadian police officer, you'll be able to get to a Gmail account, but it'll take you 6 months to do it as your request is processed through the courts in the US. If you're a Russian general or a PLA officer with responsibility for cyber in China, you don't get that. So they see that cyber is an unlevel playing field with the United States in control of everything. So what you have is this extraordinary burgeoning cyber arms race, which works on the criminal level, it works on the industrial espionage level, and it works on the state-to-state or state-even-to-non-state terrorists, insurgents, and so on and so forth level. So this is a kind of – someone – one of the guys I interviewed for the book described it. He says if you're involved in this world of tracking what is going on, bad stuff in the web, he said it's like playing a game of seven-dimensional chess and you never know who your opponent is at any one time.
We're going to take a brief station break now and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. As you've, Misha Glennie, in your previous work on McMafia, you know that you, some people describe Putin's Russia as KGB incorporated, and we know the genesis of capitalism, if you will, in the post-Soviet era. Is that the KGB always had a relationship with criminals? The Vori Vazakoni, the thieves society. I thought of that when you mentioned the organization that exists between the KGB and the criminals, and how it's regulated, and how they are given freedom to commit crime. At the same time, when the Russian government wants to commit crime, they haul them in and use them. I understand that. In a slightly different way, the Chinese manipulate public opinion. I think they call it the 50 centers or something. They've got thousands and thousands.
They get 50 cents. It's called the Netizen Army.
We'll explain it to our audience.
The Netizen Army. So there are two things. Is that first of all, where Russia has SOM 2, the sort of huge surveillance operation, the Chinese have a rather different approach. They have something called the Great Firewall of China, which is software that filters out – the Chinese government says it's to filter out sort of pernicious Western cultural influences like pornography, and it does filter out pornography. The real reason is – I mean, you know, pornography may well be one of the reasons, but the main reason is to filter out political discussion that is inconvenient for the Chinese leadership. And in case that these things do get in, and in case also that there is debate going on in blogs and on forums and stuff like that, they have this Netizen Army, which is estimated to be about 200,000 to 300,000 strong. You have the 50 centers, the people who get paid 50 cents for refuting an argument on the internet deemed hostile to Chinese interests. Mm-hmm. You know, they come back and say, that's not true. The People's Liberation Army never invaded Tibet. You know, it was an entirely defensive war or whatever. But then you have a smaller percentage of the Netizen Army and who are active hackers, who are good hackers and who will be involved in espionage work and in particular industrial espionage work, because the primary focus of China's external internet activity is vacuuming up all they possibly can from institutions like the UN, the US government, companies which they have an interest in, You know, they do this, I mean, so fanatically, almost on steroids, that a lot of people wonder whether they ever get a chance to crunch any of this data and look at it and understand what it all means. They just seem to have this sort of tick about getting as much as they can. So that's what, or most of it is run from the People's Liberation Army, which has responsibility for cyber in both military and civilian sense. In China. And so what I think we're seeing is the emergence we're seeing the fragmentation of the internet and the emergence instead of giant intranets like the Chinese internet, the Russian internet, the American internet, the European internet, and so on, which, you know, each of them have different laws and restrictions on them and different approaches to people who are perceived of committing crimes. Now, let's take a look at the United States. I've got a wonderful example of this because my daughter, about 3 months ago, was due to be taken to the airport by a friend at about 6 o'clock in the morning, somewhere else in London, and she lives with me. So she left home at 6 o'clock in the evening and was meant to go to her friend's. And then at 1:30 in the morning, I got a phone call from her friend saying, "Where is Sasha, my daughter?" And I said, "She left to stay with you, and you know, about 6 hours ago, and it's a 20-minute drive or whatever." So we didn't know. She wasn't answering her phone. And this was a really serious matter. I thought she might be lying in a ditch somewhere. And so I had no option but to hack into her Facebook, which I did. Now, I was able to hack into her Facebook, not because I'm a tech or anything like that, but because my daughter, knowing how she works, she told me her password about 5 years ago. And, of course, it's still the same one. That's sort of ABC golden rule of passwords and stuff. But so I got into there. I tracked her down through that. She was absolutely furious that I'd hacked into her Facebook account, of course, but she understood that she had made a mistake. Now, had I done this in the United States, because of recent legislation that Congress has passed, my daughter, because she's 19, she's of age, she could have taken me to court for unauthorized access, and she could have tried to put me in prison for 3 years because I hacked into her Facebook account, regardless of the fact that I was worried that she, you know, something might have happened to her. We are getting ever more draconian punishments, which are, you know, across the board. Exceeding authorized access is a blanket thing. And of course, this is not just, although it is about cybercrime and industrial espionage and that sort of thing, it's also about things like WikiLeaks. It's also things about Anonymous and Lulzsec, these groups of idealist hackers who are not motivated by financial gain, but actually by a kind of slightly inchoate, half-baked anarchism and a very anti-statist ideology at that. So, again, you know, what I came across writing Dark Market, which is essentially a thriller about this website, Dark Market, and it's not so much to do with all these issues, but again, when I was writing it, you find it very, very difficult to discuss one issue about the internet without it impacting on loads of others. And that's, I guess, in the end, I concluded that it's the very genius of the internet is its interconnectedness. That's why it works so fantastically. But it is also a very, very dangerous Achilles heel.
Well, clearly governments go after other governments' crown jewels. We've discussed that. And you just brought up WikiLeaks, which is in trouble apparently.
Financial trouble.
Yeah. And not to mention its poster boy is a troubled individual, clearly.
He's a very interesting character, Assange, because he conforms to when I was doing Dark Market, a lot of it is based on interviews with criminal hackers, and the really smart criminal hackers who have real technical ability, almost an Asperger-y technical ability, but combine this with a very persuasive, manipulative personality, and this combines in psychological terms to be a sort of psychopathic personality. The way that they act, the super criminals who I met, I would say, in terms of their socio-psychological profile, they're identical to Assange, who is very brilliant, very gifted. He is a hyper-narcissist, and he has different standards for other people to conform to and than himself.
Right. He can dish it out, but he can't take it.
That's right.
In terms of being a journalist.
In terms of being a journalist, yes. Right. He, you know, runs crying to the courts whenever he feels as though he's been insulted, and yet he's happy to hand out everyone else's details left, right, and center. But he's coming up with a really important issue, and this is the issue of the right to digital freedom, freedom of information, and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex set of issues which are embodied in Assange. But it's his personality which is really most intriguing as far as I am concerned, because it does conform to the personalities of some of those I met, the high-end people that I met involved in cybercrime. The problem is that when you get an organization like WikiLeaks that is focused on a personality like that with psychopathic traits and tendencies, it means that when it starts to unravel, the whole thing, WikiLeaks, starts to unravel very, very quickly. And as you say, I mean, not only are they in financial trouble, he's in personal trouble as well. But the impact of his work has been absolutely enormous, particularly within governments and above all else within the United States, because of the cable leaks. And
all of which came from the one source.
All of which came from the one source, which was a military source.
Remember, right, Bradley Manning, and he was one of a million people with that same clearance. That tells me that it was just a matter of time before
that happened. Absolutely right. It was, you know, why this happened, WikiLeaks, was because after 9/11, you know, there was this the revelations that there was very poor interagency sharing of information and data, which you know, helped assisted the attackers on 9/11, and so everyone was told that they had to share. And of course, because the State Department of all the agencies is as touchy and feely as you get in the U.S. government, they were just happy to send out everything to everyone, and you know, they were all very pleased. Now, the intelligence agencies were very unhappy about this new policy. Paradoxically, what Assange has done, although I think what he did was very, very interesting and well worthwhile in many ways, but paradoxically, he has actually strengthened the hands of intelligence agencies who demand secrecy and non-sharing of data. And we've seen that with President Obama's announcement 3 weeks ago about the, you know, real tightening up of data protection, particularly right. of classified data protection.
And also they're back to stovepiping now.
So in some respects, they never even left stovepiping because, I mean, in Dark Market, this was amazing. I mean, the story of Dark Market is it's this website which was the sort of superstore for criminals. And the FBI managed to infiltrate an undercover agent to become one of the five administrators of the site. So he was, you know, getting all sorts of information about the site. And the book is the story about who was he. It's, as I say, a sort of thriller in that sense. But one of the things that I uncovered when I was researching this was that unbeknownst to each other, the U.S. Secret Service, which also had a parallel dark market operation, was investigating the FBI undercover agent, and the FBI were investigating the undercover Secret Service agent. And it wasn't until they both went to the Serious Organized Crime Agency in London, the UK agency, and they both said, "We need your help in tracking down this guy in London," that the Serious Organized Crime Agency suddenly realized, wait a minute, they're investigating each other. And they, London, had to go to Washington and say, do you know what your guys are up to? It was incredibly embarrassing. And that's what happens when you stovepipe and you're working a beat like cybercrime.
Right. So what is the ratio then between stings and real criminal activity? Because we know, you know, that on every level, the government does that, whether it's stinging a cocaine dealer or putting some plutonium on the market.
Well, you can't tell. You know? I mean, you know, you can only tell if you happen to be the people who are mounting the sting operations. The problem they have in in cyber is that you have very, very different legislation for cyber that goes from country to country. So obviously, I mean, you know, if you're involved in cyber crime, it doesn't matter where you are. You can commission a crime in Kazakhstan to be perpetrated against somebody's computer in, I don't know, Southern California, and then you can cash out the money in Dubai, right? Well, you know, oops, sorry. If you're a criminal, it doesn't really matter.
So
you can do that. But if you're a cop, right,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you mount a sting operation, say, out of the United States, and I'll tell you a concrete case from Dark Market. They had to cooperate with local German police. Now, you have a real problem in Germany, because if you're stalking someone, be they a cyber criminal or a suspected paedophile or something like that, you're pretending to be, say, you know, a 13-year-old girl, and you're allowing the paedophile to groom you. If the paedophile writes in the exchange with you, "Are you an officer of the German police?" you are legally obliged to write back, "Yes, I am an officer of the German police," right? So stings have limited value in Germany if you're dealing with a smart person. Whereas here, of course, stings are basically, it's kind of, you know, it's 101 of federal policing in the U.S.
So again, I'm speaking with Misha Glinny, author of Dark Market, a brand new book, subtitle of which is Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. And this is a fascinating area, and we could talk on here forever. But let me just get to a question that I have, which is, you know, we're always told here in the United States that private enterprise works and government doesn't. And we've spoke mostly about the government and whether they're on the advantage or disadvantage vis-a-vis cyber war. Clearly, when you have proprietorial knowledge, and arguably the only strength of our economy going forward since we've essentially eradicated our industrial base and given it to China, is intellectual property. Whether it's in the internet world or in pharmaceuticals or whatever, that is our strength. Or movies, that's intellectual property as well. And we know how much it's stolen. So what's going on in terms of corporate America protecting its intellectual property, where you got a potential for a lot of money being stolen, and you would think that they're pretty good at it.
Well, it's appropriate that we're having this conversation here, Ian, just over the road from Universal Studios, because this is having a devastating impact, of course, on the movie industry here. If we look at the industry which has been most affected, that is the music industry, basically paid sales through the internet, through CDs, or whatever, are collapsing and have been collapsing now for over 10 years. What you have to understand is you have to work from the reality on the ground. The reality is that anyone under the age of 35 believes it is their God-given right to download anything they want from the internet for free, and they do. I defy you to find me a 27-year-old or a 22-year-old who doesn't download movies from illegal, you know, of unauthorized sites on the web. I mean, it doesn't happen.
So they don't pay.
And that's the reality that we have to work from. Now, in the music industry, you've seen how they've adapted to that. And a lot of bands have basically felt they have to embrace this reality. Now, in music, you have the ability, nonetheless, to go touring. And you've seen this incredible upsurge of touring because of the internet, and this is the way that they generate revenue now, and they generate revenue through merchandise and so on and so forth. Makes it very difficult for up-and-coming bands, but basically what they do is they put their music out on the net, and they get a much bigger audience much more quickly than they were able to in the past. So the music industry is adapting in a way that, of course, the movie industry can't adapt. It simply can't do that. You can't have a roadshow in that sense. Authors, like myself, I mean, McMafia, when it came out, I clock everything that happens to McMafia. And McMafia has been pirated and it's, you know, touted around PDFs on the net, so I don't get any royalties for it. There's very little I can do about that.
So you mean the growth of Kindles mean the growth of losing revenue?
Kindle is potentially very dangerous. I mean, the publishing industry is in free fall at the moment,
right,
for two reasons. One, because the internet has changed the way kids read and absorb information in particular, and the last thing they want to do is to sit down with a quiet book and curl up with a cup of hot chocolate and read the book. And they never leave the internet, and they don't read books on the internet. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that, you know, piracy is moving ahead for the book industry as well, and publishers are all scrambling to try and work out what they do about their collapsing revenue. The same with newspapers. We simply don't know how it's going to pan out and who's going to come up with the genius answer for revenue raising on this. So for those involved in the creative industries, this is an immense challenge. And it's a challenge that we haven't yet found an answer to. Now, you know, if anyone can, it's the film industry, because they have a lot of money and they're very powerful.
And they're the most vulnerable in it.
But they are the most vulnerable, you know, and there's very little you can do. It's not just about, I mean, there's the, you know, all the warnings you get when you go to the movies about not recording it on your mobile phone and stuff like that. But, you know, it's well past recording it on your mobile phone and then sending around the internet. People hack into where the data is kept, where the movies are kept. And when I was in China, this was investigating McMafia, is that they were advertising, one of the fake DVD sellers was advertising them as genuine fakes. Right? And what he meant by that was that it had actually come from a master copy,
right? Oh,
and that it wasn't one of the wobbly ones, you know. And so you go and see, I don't know, the latest movie, Puss in Boots 3D, and it's all in Ukrainian, right? It wasn't that sort of stuff.
Right.
Which, I mean, I did get some of those movies because I bought them, for purposes of investigation only. This is a really, really tricky issue, and it is. What I realized, this was when I was doing McMafia, but everything I've done with Dark Market confirms it, is that it's an issue which is actually at the heart of relations between the Western world and China. And as you pointed out, we've all kissed goodbye to our manufacturing industry, except the Germans, it would appear. And you know, all we've got is the fact that we can tell great stories and crack good jokes and play good music. And if we can't sell that anyhow, you know, we're all screwed.
Well, on that note, Misha Glinney, I would suggest that your book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You, may well be the window into the future, that the bad guys, the future belongs to the bad guys, right? Would that be a fair summary?
They're certainly in there with a good shout, is what I'd say.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Ian.
And we've just been joined by Misha Glenny, a former BBC Central Europe correspondent. He covered the fall of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He is the author of McMafia, The Rebirth of History, The Fall of Yugoslavia, which won the Overseas Press Club Award and the Best Book from Foreign Affairs in 1993, and The Balkans, Nationalism, War, and the Great Powers, 1804 to 1999. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again at Sunday at 11 a.m. with Background Briefing. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.